All right, you're listening to WHUS 91.7 FM. I am Fran Storch, and you are about to hear Radio Naturopath for the next hour. We invite you to participate in our show. The number to call is 860-486-9487. That's 860-486-9487. Ron is awaiting anxiously to answer your questions or to take your questions so I can answer them.
Very anxious this morning.
Yeah, he might be able to help. Are you extra anxious this morning?
No.
Oh. Are you anxious at all?
Usually.
You could have some lemon balm or magnesium or lavender or oat straw or passion flower or what's another good nerving? Catnip.
Isn't it great when the doctor's in the house?
Yeah. Yeah, because I can tell you doctor stuff.
Doctor stuff.
It's very cool. Okay. So we had something from last week that I was talking about, and we didn't finish it.
What was that?
And no. Well, you had it.
I had it. Oh, dear.
Okay.
Well, this would be from last week. Let me see. Let's see. We had talked to a few people last week. We'd talked to someone who was having a problem with Lyme and was allergic to doxy, and
we
had a problem there. We were talking to a swimmer from Andover who had allergy to lake water.
Right.
And respiratory issues.
Okay, yes. That was a good question.
Yeah, that was a good question.
Yeah.
And then we had Dana from Baltic.
Yes.
And I have something that says steroids here, but I'm not sure exactly. I don't have
So we might have been talking about
catabolic
steroids for let me talk about that for a minute. I want to do that. So let's talk about catabolic steroids. So first of all, let's define our terms. Remember the difference between catabolic and anabolic steroids. A catabolic steroid, the word steroid just means it has a particular ring structure. Shout out to that nice fella who works for Beltane Farms, the goat cheese farm. You know, the farm with the goats.
Yes.
Because he was standing there at the store's farmer's market, and I noticed on his leg he had a tattoo. And the tattoo was a steroid ring. And I wasn't sure what compound it was, but I recognized the steroid ring. How many people would walk up to him and go, "Oh, you have a steroid ring?"
I know of one.
Yeah. Well, I did. And
you did.
And it was testosterone.
Yes.
It was just tattooed onto his leg. And it had, wasn't sure which one it was, but I recognized the steroid structure. It's a bunch of hexagonal ring structures that are hooked together, and it has a sort of a split-level feel to it. There's two hexagons on bottom attached to, then there's another one that's on top of the second one, and then it goes off to the side, and that's a steroid ring. That's what it looks like. And what you're looking at is the way a whole bunch of carbons and hydrogens and oxygens are hooked together, and the ring structure. There's four ring structures there with some stuff coming off it, and they're hexagonal shaped in space. They must have figured that out with electron microscopes, and that's how they know this. So that's what a steroid is. It has to have that ring structure. If it's anabolic, it's going to make you grow. It's going to make tissue grow. So your estrogen and testosterone are anabolic steroids. Anabolic steroids can also be designer versions of these. They're not exactly estrogen and testosterone, but they're designer versions, and they're things that people illegally take, or they take in gyms to make themselves get bigger. Then catabolic steroids, in our bodies, cortisol, cortisone, those have a steroid ring structure as well. They break tissue down, but they still have that same ring structure. If you look at cortisol, you'll see there's a steroid ring in it as well. So it breaks down tissue. And you need that in your body because you need to be able to do your fight or flight, and you need to be able to burn fuel to get that fuel into your cells so you could do stuff. So, you know, if I'm going to go climb a hill, I want to have some cortisol breaking down sugar and fat so I can get that into my cells to run my electron transport chain so I can get up the hill. And that is normal. So here's the interesting thing. People are often given steroids to treat their allergies. That's really common. They're given steroids to treat inflammation. They're given to treat allergies. They're given to treat skin rashes. They're given to treat digestive problems. They're given to treat any sort of inflammation in the body that they can't manage to get down. They'll even give steroids sometimes to treat migraines because migraines have a component of inflammation of the blood vessels. So what they do is they suppress inflammation. There's a part of the inflammatory system that they suppress, and that's why they're used. And they have many functions, though. Cortisol has many functions in the body. It puts sugar into your blood so you have energy to do stuff. It does break down tissue, and it moderates your immune system. Small physiological amounts of cortisol will make you feel energized. Too much cortisol will shut your energy down and will shut your immune system down. So the reason they're given to reduce inflammation is because they suppress the immune system. Now, in naturopathic medicine, we don't like the idea of suppression. Now, of course, if you have a very severe immune reaction of some sort, we're not completely against using steroids sometimes. But people use steroids a lot, and they're just given out randomly, and you can buy them over the counter. You can get nasal sprays like Flonase and Nasonex over the counter now. You can get cortisone creams to put on your rashes over the counter. They're not going to be as strong as the ones you get for a prescription, but they are steroids. They're catabolic steroids. So just so you know, steroids' job is to break stuff down. It puts sugar into your blood. It breaks tissue down. That's one of its functions. That's why if you have an inflammation in your body, so you know, one of the things that will happen is if you have a joint that's severely inflamed, like you get bursitis, or you have an inflamed disc in your spine, or you have an inflamed joint, one of the things an orthopedist or some other doctor will offer you is a cortisone shot. And the reason they're doing that is because it will effectively reduce the inflammation. But you'll notice your doctor will tell you you can't have more than two or three of these shots because they break down tissue. And where you get the cortisone shot, that even though it's reducing the inflammation, it's also eating away at the tissue. So it's not an ideal way to go. And in my opinion, you know, in naturopathic medicine, we believe in the concept of first do no harm. And first do no harm means that you want to use the least harmful thing possible to help someone with their healing. So if you can avoid using something that's going to break your tissue down, it's a really good idea. And that's why for respiratory allergies, we try to get people not to use steroids. You know, I have some Nasonex or Nasacort. I just use it to get my inflammation down. And it works. But if you use it in the long term, one of the things, if you look at the package insertions or on the side of the box of those steroid sprays, you will see that it says that you're more likely to get infections and you're more likely to get yeast infections because you're suppressing the immune system of the area. So microorganisms, you're not going to have white blood cells and you're not going to have antibodies in an immune system to fight against microbes that normally live in your nose. Because in your nose right now, all of you listening, you've got bacteria, you've got mold, you've got yeast, you've got viruses. You've got them all there. It's just that right now, if you're not sick, they're not very active. Your immune system is keeping them in check. But if you keep putting steroid nasal sprays in there, the immune system will go down and you're more likely to get infections. This is true, too, if you take steroids regularly for asthma. And so, you know, people take Advair and Dulera and Symbicort, all these things. You know, Symbicort has cort at the end of it. It's got cortisone in it. It's got a catabolic steroid in it to suppress inflammation. So you keep taking those. Now your lungs are more prone to getting infections there. And because you're inhaling them, those steroids are going to go in your whole body and you're going to be more likely to get infections in general. Also, if somebody has inflammatory bowel disease, if they have an acute flare, sometimes they will be given prednisone. And prednisone, again, is a steroid, and it is suppressive to the immune system. And because your brain reacts to cortisol as well. You get so people who take steroids, they'll get heightened emotionality. One of the places I remember when we were watching that show Smash a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. The woman she was a singer and she had some swelling in her throat because she was singing so much. So her vocal cords were swollen. So she was given a course of steroids and she got loopy. She got really emotional and she was very irritable. And that's a thing that can happen too if you take enough steroid. So steroids should be, I'm not saying you should never use them. I'm saying they should be used judiciously, and they should not be used in the cavalier manner that they are. That is what I see. So if you have respiratory allergies, it's a good idea to find out how to treat those naturally. Eat less sugar. Find out if you have food intolerances. Clean your nose out. Saline nasal spray will not reduce your immune system. All it will do is clean your nose out, and the salt that's in there will kill the microorganisms that are in there. You throw in a drop of tea tree oil, you're going to do even better. So, you know, you can use your neti pot, you can use a bulb syringe, you can use a Q-tip and clean your nose out that way. For asthma, asthma's tougher, it's true. And if you find that you can't treat asthma any other way than with steroids, okay, but I have to tell you that I've had success in my practice helping people with asthma with herbs that aren't immunosuppressive. They moderate the immune system and they help with the tonicity of the lungs. I have lovely herbs like Kella and Areodictyon yerbasanta, Mullein.
You got a face for me on that one.
Elecampane. Isn't that a cool name for an herb, elecampane?
Elecampane. We used to have a governor by the name of Ella Grasso.
Oh, boy. Hmm. Yeah, and before she was governor, there was an elecampane.
Okay.
Ow! All right.
Right.
Yeah.
So, that's really bad.
Licorice is also a great herb for your lungs. You just have to be careful if you take too much of it, because if you're a person who has high blood pressure, it's not a good thing. Conversely, if you have low blood pressure and low blood sugar, you tend to get low blood sugar, licorice is an herb that might be very helpful for you. So there are alternatives to steroids. Getting that steroid shot for your sore joint, well, it depends on what's going on. If you have bursitis, I like to use high-dose vitamin B6. That can often be helpful for bursitis. This is a time when you can use hydrotherapies and Epsom salt baths, and there are topicals that contain various herbs that are healing for inflamed joints. So they have things like dandelion and daisy and arnica and rustox and ruta graveolens, different combinations of topical things. I like EFAC, esterified fatty acids. That can be done locally. You can go to your chiropractor or to your physical therapist, and they can do cool stuff for your joints. My chiropractor does cold laser and ultrasound, and he will phonophorese stuff into me.
He will do what?
Phonophorese. Isn't that a great word?
What in the world is phonophorese?
Yeah, phonophoresis. Okay, it's when you do ultrasound and you put something on the skin and you take the ultrasound wand and you do ultrasound over the substance, and it drives the substance into the skin and therefore ultimately into the muscles.
Really?
So Dr. Suez phonophoreses esterified fatty acid cream into my muscles, and it's great.
So it's almost like injecting it through your skin.
Yeah, but you use an ultrasound, because when you get ultrasound, it's warm. It gets hot,
right,
on your skin.
Right.
So the heat, you're driving sound. Ultrasound is sound waves. So you're pushing sound waves, and it increases circulation. That's basically what you're doing, is you're increasing circulation and softening up the tissue and making it warm so that you get more circulation to the area so you can get more healing. And I love my ultrasound. It's so nice to get it. So he's been phonophoresing esterified fatty acids in, but you can get phonophoresed other stuff, beneficial minerals like magnesium. Magnesium is a great thing to phonophorese in, or copper. Copper is very healing for joints. So you can get arnica salve phonophoresed in. But I would probably, if I was going to get phonophoresis, I would want to do magnesium. Probably my two. I really like doing the EFAC, the esterified fatty acid cream, and that's really nice. And the esterified fatty acid cream, you could use BioFreeze too. The esterified fatty acid cream also had menthol in it, and the menthol has salicylates in it, which are anti-inflammatory. So you can use anything with salicylates in it and get that phonophoresed in, the tiger balm or...
And a salicylate is what?
A salicylate is a compound that comes from various plants. It comes from willow, from meadowsweet, from feverfew, and willow, meadowsweet, feverfew, and there might be another one. Anyway, willow's Latin name is salix, and so salicylates come from salix, and also meadow sweet and feverfew. But salicylates are a compound that comes from willow, and they are anti-inflammatory. Do you know what the chemical name of aspirin is?
No.
Acetyl salicylic acid.
Okay.
Right. So it's an analog of salicylate. So salicylates are anti-inflammatory.
Okay.
And you can phonophorese those in. And so, like, if you have, you could get willow tincture, and you could phonophorese that in.
So this would be a pain management thing.
Yeah, pain and inflammation.
And inflammation also.
Yes, you could phonophorese any. You could make a tincture or a salve with lots of different cool stuff in it. You could put in any salicylate, like willow. Willow is a great one, and so is meadow sweet and spirea. And feverfew, those are great. You could also do antispasmodics, like cramp bark would be a good one, as well as wild yam. People think of wild yam for women's stuff, but it's a great antispasmodic, and as well as black cohosh. Those are all herbs that are really terrific for pain and spasm, and you could get tinctures of them, or you know, put them in a salve and get them phonophoresed into a sore joint, and that would be really helpful.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
So phonophoresis, so this is something you can talk to either a physical therapist about or a chiropractor that happens to have an ultrasound, that has ultrasound.
You need ultrasound equipment in order to do this.
Yeah, right.
And all this time I thought ultrasounding was just for looking inside.
No, you can do ultrasound for, haven't I been telling you I go to Dr. Swayze, he does ultrasound on me?
I don't know if you told me that part.
All right. Yeah, he's been doing ultrasound on my arm. It's wonderful. Yeah, and when I had, he did it on when my hamstring was bad. He was doing it on my hamstring,
too. You just
say
he's the magic chiropractor,
yeah,
that's all.
He's not, yeah, he's a nice guy. So,
shout out to Paul Swayze.
Yes. So he does this, so he does it there, and I'm sure there are other chiropractors also. Maybe, I don't know if the other chiropractors in the area do it, but you should ask him. But Brian Batherson, shout out to him, and shout out to Alex Celestri, and shout out to Bob Dubois. I'm not sure if he says Dubois or Du Bois. But anyway, he's in North Windham.
Yeah.
Okay. So shout out to him. Shout out to Anastasios Balos. He's in Plainfield. Shout out to Dr. McNamara. I'm trying to shout out to all the chiropractors. Dr. McNamara, who is in Danielson.
So chiropractic care is not just the skeletal alignment.
Not necessarily. Chiropractors, you know, when I was in Oregon, so we had National College of Natural Medicine, which gave you a naturopathic degree. Also in Portland was Western States Chiropractic College. Mm-hmm. And also in Portland was the Oregon College of Oriental Medicine. And they shared professors, and we knew each other. Like, you would know people from Western States, and you would certainly know people from OCOM, because OCOM was walking distance from NCNM. So,
well, you're all under that, I guess you would call it alternative umbrella.
Yeah. So. And there was a lot of crossover. I mean, when I was in naturopathic college, we learned about acupuncture and we learned naturopathic manipulation. Naturopaths manipulate, chiropractors adjust. So only chiropractors, they have jurisdiction over the word adjust. But yeah, chiropractors in some states can be primary care physicians.
Wow.
And they can order labs and stuff. Yeah, they learn all about the body just like we do. No, it's not just for your back. The belief in chiropractic is that disease emanates from misalignments of the spine, which kind of makes sense because your entire spine has nerve connections to every part of your body.
Oh, sure.
So
everything,
if your spine is
there,
misaligned,
sure,
you can have problems. And so some chiropractors directly practice that way. Some are less rigorous about that. But certainly one of the things you can do when you're not feeling well is go get adjusted. And that's with anything. It doesn't have to just be my back hurts. If you're sick, if you have a cold, if I happen to have a cold and I go to Dr. Swayze, adjust my neck, he'll even adjust my face. And so if you have stomach problems, you have GI upset, you can get your pelvis adjusted and it might help. I had a chiropractor tell me there was a woman who was overdue with her baby, and she was having trouble. She wasn't, the birth wasn't progressing, and she didn't want to do, she didn't want to get induced. So she said, all right, before I go get induced, I'll go see the chiropractor. He adjusted her, and she had to make a run for it. And that was it. The baby's born.
Really?
Yeah.
Just like that.
She's misaligned, which can really happen when you're pregnant. And by the way, if you're
well,
pregnant,
yeah,
go to the chiropractor.
You've got this other object inside of you. You've got this being inside of you, which can certainly misalign you.
The neat thing about being pregnant is your body is dynamic. It's changing by the minute. So you were the way you were yesterday is not how you are today because your baby keeps growing. So your balance keeps shifting and everything keeps changing. And chemically, you keep changing as the baby grows. It's a good time. I was looking at Mila Kunis on she was on TV this morning. Mila Kunis is a because of that silly mom movie that's out. There's a movie about bad moms.
Okay.
And it's a silly comedy, and she's in it. So it's really funny because she was on TV this morning, and I turned my head away. I'm like, oh my goodness, it's Meg Griffin on TV. But Mila Kunis is a beautiful woman, and you know she's married now to Ashton Kutcher, and she's pregnant. She's having her second child. So she was talking about the pregnancy, and she said her first pregnancy she couldn't get enough sour. She wanted vinegar and stuff, which is very common during pregnancy. This pregnancy she can't eat meat. She craves it and wants it, and then she goes to eat, and she's like, nope, that's not happening.
That's weird, isn't it?
Yeah, the things that happen with cravings. So anyway, getting back to your steroids. So there's a lot of things you can do instead of using catabolic steroids to help your health. And there's a lot of things you could do naturally. And the thing is, one of the concerns is that if you have an inflamed joint or an inflamed part, that part has some damage to it. And if you then go put a steroid on top of it, you get enough of that steroid, you're going to hasten the damage.
Okay.
So it's better to do stuff that nourishes that part. So if you take esterified fatty acids, if you eat adequate protein, if you take antioxidants, if you, especially if you eat adequate protein, you can take substances like flavococcids and collagen substances that will actually provide nutrition to help rebuild the joint. You can eat bone broth, and bone broth is a really interesting substance. Bone broth is where you boil down, very healthy bones from a chicken or from beef or from pork.
We have a bunch in the freezer that I made.
So yeah. when you boil that stuff down, you're getting bone marrow in a broth. And what's in bone marrow? Stem cells. So all the nutrients you need to regrow tissue is in bone broth. So bone broth is very healing. If you eat bone broth regularly, you might have less arthritis. Everything can heal you. I mean, when you eat, we give you bone broth. The thing bone broth is frequently used for, you hear about it in the GAPS diet and helping people who have inflammatory bowel disease because it's very effective at helping heal the digestive system. But if as you absorb it, it can heal anything because it's got stem cells in it. So bone broth, but we should be eating that more.
We probably should. We have a lot. I made a bunch over the winter.
So let's make a. We should make a soup.
We baked a few chickens and roasted a few chickens.
We could make a nice summery
soup.
So
I made. We had a lot. So I made a bunch.
We should make Tom Kar Gow. Tom Kar Gow. That delicious Thai coconut soup.
Okay.
And use the bone broth as a base.
You should find me a recipe.
Okay, find your recipe. We'll do it. It'll be delicious. And because very refreshing for the summer, because it's a little minty, a little cilantro-y. So let me make sure that's the name of it, and I'll encourage all of you to try that. Tom Kar Gow. Tom Har Gow, sorry. And then, of course, I'm finding it's also called Tom Ka Gai. Anyway, so it's Thai coconut galangal chicken soup. And it doesn't have to have chicken. It can be vegetarian, but the base has chicken broth in it. If you want to do a vegetarian base, you can do that. And coconut, and then you put galangal in. Galangal, I don't know if that's how you say it. Galangal is a very spicy herb that tastes a lot like ginger. Really healthy for you. Really lovely. It's really delicious soup. When I go to the Thai restaurant, that's one of the things I like to get. So I recommend it. It's got all kinds of healthy stuff in it. And then in terms of steroids. So the thing with steroids is if you have a very serious condition, like you have multiple sclerosis or you have inflammatory bowel disease, and you have an acute flare, and you're in a very serious situation. I'm not saying that at that point you should avoid steroids. If it's an emergency situation, you probably need to take the steroids because you need to get yourself. I mean, at a time in times when we didn't have steroids, people died of such flares. And if you have inflammatory bowel disease, you can get a bowel blockage. And that's very dangerous. So to prevent that, and if you have multiple sclerosis and you have an acute, very serious flare, if your nerves flare enough, it can be life-threatening. So if your life is in danger and you have to take a catabolic steroid to get you out of danger, that's one thing. But this chronic use, the fact that it's used over-the-counter. Oh, I didn't talk about skin rashes. So people use cortisone. They use topical. They use topical steroids that you can buy in the drugstore for minor skin rashes, and they use cortisone, which is, I just think that's an overuse.
Yeah.
It's just. That's something, you know, you shouldn't just have it. Oh, I have a little itch. I'll use some cortisone cream. Not smart.
Yeah. Oh, I see that a lot. I see people doing that a lot.
Because there's wonderful stuff you can get. You can get salves with tea tree oil in it. You can get salves with calendula and aloe and berberines and lavender. So they have a combination of nervines and calendula, which is just one of the most lovely healing plants ever. Comfrey. Also, calendula and comfrey are just lovely topically. They can help because they help with normal cell differentiation and they help to heal. Like you used that calendula cream when you had your road rash, when you had your bicycle crash.
Yep.
You started by using some Neosporin, some, you know, triple antibiotic.
Right.
But in the end, you did away with that and you found that the calendula cream is the best thing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that
I kind of used the Neosporin stuff just to make sure I didn't get any additional infection or anything like that.
Except that the calendula cream will do that too. The
probably,
calendula cream has antimicrobials in it.
Yep.
And in the end, you felt like it worked better.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just amazing stuff. I used the calendula cream. I had second degree burns on my hands and I used that and made it go away. And also, when my burns were healing, my hands itched. So I put.
Well, that's normal.
So I put calendula cream on it and it made the itch go away.
Mm-hmm.
It was great.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to use steroids for every little thing. And my opinion is you shouldn't. It's not a good idea.
Right.
Because it eats away a tissue. And the thing is, in naturopathic medicine, we have stuff that instead of eating away at the tissue, it actually builds the tissue up. So that makes sense to me. Why would you want to suppress inflammation? Wouldn't you want to enhance your immune system, treat the cause of what's going on, and rebuild tissue instead of breaking it down?
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
All right.
I was just reading about bone broth.
Yes, yes, do tell.
Yeah, different things. There's just the ways to make bone broth. There's a bunch of opinions out there, but it seems that one person's opinion is that you actually roast the bones before you put them into, you know, make them into the broth.
Okay.
And they kind of caramelize a little bit, and then you put them in and go that route on it, which supposedly brings out more of the nutrients. I'm not real sure if that's true or not. But they also go with a method that is only 3 or 4 hours. And everything I have read before this is that as close to 24 hours or more is a better way to make the broth.
I would go with the 24 hours.
I like the 24-hour one because it seems like everything's going to leach out better.
Yes.
Because it's going to really sit in there for a long time. So you take your bones and you throw them into a pot and any other scraps that may have occurred from the beast that you were cooking.
And it could be a chicken. It could be pork.
Could be a chicken. Could be beef. Could be
and
pork.
And very, very important. You really want to get one that was cleanly raised. It's not a good idea to just get it from any old supermarket chicken.
Right.
It's better to do a free-range chicken if you're going to do bone broth and you really want it to heal you, it's almost like you kind of need to know the farmer.
Yeah.
Either that or go to the really good health food store
and
get a grass-fed organic bone, if it's a beef bone, if it's pork. See, I would go to like the good farm to get.
Yeah. Well, we got our last one from the local CSA down the street from us that sells chickens.
Right.
And she has a lot of chickens.
Right.
And so that's where that last batch I made came from. So
we're pretty
certain that everything was very cleanly done there.
Right.
Because they're very particular about
how
they do
exactly.
things.
Exactly.
So. Anyway, the 24-hour thing, I think, is really what we're looking for here. And I throw in, I'll cut up an onion, throw it in there. I'll throw a few things in just right. to add a little flavor, put a bay leaf in there, you know, just kind of make it a little bit more brothy also.
And if
in
you're
that
doing
respect.
It if you're doing it for general healing and you don't have any, you know, flared inflammation, you can do that. If you have raging inflammatory bowel disease and you're trying to be on and you're trying to really heal your gut, and like you're sick and you're like either doing the specific carbohydrate diet or you're doing the IBDA diet and you're trying to get inflammation down, you might not want to put those things in that Ron suggested just because anything could upset you right now. But if you're, you know,
right.
if you're just trying to get natural healing done and you're not particularly, you're just like trying to improve your health, then you can season it however you like.
Right. Depending on the method that you look at, some people say don't put in, you know, you don't need to put in anything a lot extra
right.
than what. I like to just throw a little something in there to have a little
yeah.
flavor to
for
it.
For us, too. It's fine.
You know, because I'm going to use it as a soup stock. I'm
right.
going to use it for making other things. That's
right.
my purpose for doing that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, if you're really sick, you can just cook up the bone broth, just warm up the bone broth and just, you know, sip
Even
on that.
Even if you
really
have
good.
Acute, you know, if you have an, if you're either, if you have
joint pain,
anything at all,
arthritis,
you know,
right.
or you have a cold, or you have a cough,
yeah.
or you have a digestive upset, if you can stomach the bone broth is probably the best thing you could eat.
Well, we have lots of medicine in the freezer.
Okay. So. Well, I think we should make Tom Kha Gai.
Okay. That's good.
Yeah. Delicious.
Mm.
Didn't you find a coconut milk in the cabinet?
We have coconut milk in the house, yes.
Yes, so that would be something we could do with it.
Right.
Yeah, make Tom Kha Gai. We'll make Tom Kha Gai. We'll let you know. We have to find Galangal, though.
Right.
Galangal.
That, of course.
Galangal. I don't know if I'm saying it right.
So I got a call. You know, earlier, we're just going to snap back here just a little bit. We're talking about the lake issue. Remember the swimmer that called us with the lake issue?
Yes.
Well, I got a call from Chuck and Tolland, who is listening to the show. Shout out to Chuck and Tolland.
Hi, Chuck.
He loves the show.
Yes.
Thanks, Chuck. Anyway, he said that the DEEP has been treating lakes lately because of it's part of their lake water quality management program. So they have concerns about biological matter growing in the lakes, and apparently they put, because of the dense algae blooms, nuisance weed beds, depletion of oxygen from the bottom waters. These conditions limit recreation opportunities and reduce the economical value of the property, blah, blah, blah. So going on down the line. So what they do is they put some sort of an agent in the water to take care of the plants that are growing at the bottom of the lake that are causing problems with the water. So this is, it was most recently done in Coventry at Eagleville Lake, and there's a question, maybe they did Coventry Lake also, maybe Columbia Lake also was treated. One of the things it says is after it is done, you really shouldn't swim in the lake for at least 5 days until after everything
wow.
is settled out.
And do they tell people this?
Well, the information that I am reading says there are postings, but I don't always find that those postings occur. But anyway, they're supposed to post. That's what's supposed to happen. They're supposed to post. And they don't want you swimming in the water, and they don't want you fishing in the water either.
Wow.
So,
what are they putting in?
I don't know. Some sort of an herbicide, I would think, to kill the weeds, which is not good. So this gentleman that called us was having all the problems with his, you know, sinuses and all. He may have been exposed to a chemical agent. That's a possibility. If he didn't see the sign, because maybe there was a sign posted, or if there were no signs posted. So I am trying to find, and have not been able to find, a schedule of from the DEEP of when they treat the lakes and if they have a list, but I can't seem to find anything. So if anyone out there from the DEEP is listening and they have that information and they could send it over to us, we'd really appreciate it. Because that would be a good thing to know, and it would
yeah.
be a good thing to be able to access every year, because there, as you know, swimming and boating occur and fishing occurs in the spring, it would seem that it would be a nice thing. You'll note Occasionally there are notices in the news that say, you know, that such and such a place has been closed for swimming.
Right.
And I think that's because they're treating the water.
Yeah, it might be. And it, well, and also because there might be, it's also, we talked about this in Halifax for the coliforms.
Right.
When the coliform count goes too high, they'll close it down.
Right.
That's why you can't swim in Mansfield Hollow Lake, because it's a reservoir.
Right.
And if too many tushies go in the water, you get the excess of coliforms.
Right.
Not that there are no coliforms in Mansfield Hollow Lake anyway, because, you know, the beavers and the raccoons and the frogs and the snakes, they don't pay attention. You tell them there's no swimming in the lake and they don't listen.
They don't listen.
No. Yeah. They just go swimming in the
lake. My dog never listened either.
No.
No. He just dove in.
I know. And people sometimes fall out of their kayaks.
It has been known to happen.
And they don't seem to be upset by it. They seem to enjoy falling out of their kayaks.
Usually a warm day that occurs.
Yeah, and they sort of stay out of their kayaks and having fallen in.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
And seem to be smiling at other people who have also fallen out of their kayaks. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, you know, that's what summer does. Summer
falling out of kayaks.
I think it creates a general instability in all boats.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And when it gets really, really hot out, that your boat just becomes incredibly unstable and you just can't control it anymore and you just simply fall out.
Yeah.
So, and then you have to crawl back in, and sometimes when you crawl back in, you fall right back out again.
I know.
Yeah, and then sometimes you have to swim the boat back into shore so you can get back in too.
Yeah,
so.
I know.
It does happen. Yeah, so... So anyway, that was a nice suggestion that we got from Chuck.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden this would become a problem for someone.
Right.
So
yeah,
that
was another issue that he could have been exposed to that. So, all right. So, let me see. Did you know that there was a study that says that cycling may help lower the risk for type 2 diabetes?
Well,
given how much I've ridden my...
How do we spell this? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
Anyway, so because of the level of riding I've been doing lately, I guess I'm not a good candidate for diabetes.
Well, I would think that it would probably be farthest from your concern. But,
yeah.
But, you know, you never know. I had a friend who was... managing his type 1 diabetes by
cycling. Type 1 diabetes.
By cycling, yes.
Yes.
And he could actually regulate it, and he could use less insulin because of the fact that he was riding his bike.
Well, sure.
There's even a cycling team in the U.S. that
yes.
is a professional cycling team, right?
Yes.
That
uh-huh.
is a type 1 team.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it's Team Novo Nordisk.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's probably a running team too and a running program around it, but obviously, you know, you can adjust and regulate meds.
So I'm not sure if Team Novo Nordisk is all that everyone in Team Novo Nordisk has diabetes. I'm not sure if they all have type 1 or type 2. It doesn't say.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it doesn't say right here. It's international. There's no team, because Novo Nordisk is not an American company. It's
no.
I think what
is Novo Nordisk?
Novo Nordisk is a pharmaceutical company
that makes
insulin and you know drugs for diabetes. Yeah, that's what it is.
Hmm.
Look, it says join our team. And here's the pro team. Here's pictures of the pro team. They all look like, you know, pro cyclists. They look like dudes on a pro cycling team.
They sure do.
They're always looking for athletes with it. Just says diabetes. I bet you it doesn't matter if you have type 1 or type 2. Because I see here that they are talking about Traceba, which is probably their drug. No, I'm sorry. Traceba is a form of insulin. So I know that they specialize in different insulins and delivery systems for insulin. And I'm not sure if they have drugs that are, you know, that are hypoglycemic, that are not insulin. So I'm assuming that this team, because it just says diabetes, it doesn't say whether it's type 1 or type 2. It probably doesn't matter. It could probably be either one.
So explain the difference between type 1 and type 2.
Sure. Type 1 diabetes usually is congenital. it's caused, it's an autoimmune condition. You have autoimmune destruction of the islets of Langerhans. The islets of Langerhans are cells in your pancreas where you produce insulin. So you actually have destruction of those cells.
Okay.
That's what type 1 diet, it's autoimmune destruction. It often occurs early in life because you're genetically predisposed to it, or you might have some kind of a genetic incident that, and there are some people who suspect that certain vaccinations might be responsible for it. But it's autoimmune destruction. If you have it in your family, you're more likely to get it. So there's a genetic component to the destruction of the islets of Langerhans. Type 2 diabetes is not the same thing. That's insulin resistance, and that tends to happen later in life. They used to call type 1 diabetes juvenile diabetes, mm-hmm. but you can come down with it. You don't necessarily...
My friend got it later in life. Later, but he was in his, he had to be close to 30.
So if what has happened is you have destruction of the islets of Langerhans, that's type 1 diabetes. If you have simply insulin resistance and you're still making plenty of insulin, that's type 2 diabetes. And so you make lots of insulin, your cells become resistant to the insulin. And that's what it is. And it tends to happen later in life. And there is also a genetic predisposition to it because not everybody gets it. Even though, you can have morbidly obese people who don't have diabetes. Mm-hmm. So there is a genetic component to it. And you'll see certain populations are more likely to get it. It's really common in Native American populations.
Huh.
Yeah, but because they're genetically predisposed to it.
Right.
And anyway, that the people genetically in Native American populations, they do better on a hunter-gatherer diet because that's how they evolved and that's what they were eating through time. And so when Europeans came to America and started feeding them wheat and sugar and potatoes and stuff, it made them sick. So you'll see on reservations, the rate of cancer and type 2 diabetes is really high. It's unfortunate.
Wow.
And heart disease.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if they go back to the hunter-gatherer diet, can they control their diabetes?
Generally, you can. I mean, that's one way that you control it everybody has to find their sweet spot, whatever that is. The amount of starch and sugar you can eat and be happy and healthy. Someone with type 2 diabetes can't eat as much as someone who doesn't have type 2 diabetes. Of course, that's based on what kind of exercise they're getting, because one of the cool things about exercise is exercise improves insulin sensitivity. You want your cells to be sensitive to insulin. You want to have cell membranes that have insulin receptors that are excited about having insulin bond to them, because once insulin bonds to those receptors, sugar can get into the cells. Once your body sees insulin bonding, it's not going to kick out as much or need as much. So one of the goals of both type 1 and type 2 diabetes is to need as little insulin as possible. In fact, mm-hmm. one of the goals for anyone is to need as little insulin as possible. How you need less insulin is by making sure all of your cells are sensitive to it. So the insulin that's running around can bond to the cells. Insulin bonds to the cells to open up channels so sugar can get in, so you can have metabolism, so it can get in there and power your electron transport chain and do all the other cool stuff it does. So you can't have too much sugar in the cell, so your body regulates how much insulin comes out. The other thing about insulin is insulin doesn't just bond to your cells and cause sugar to get in. Insulin increases inflammation and it causes growth. And you want some insulin around, shunting proteins into your muscles to make them grow. And you want insulin around for repair. So insulin supporting some inflammation is a good thing. So you want a little bit of inflammation when you're building a muscle, when you're, doing weightlifting or you're doing whatever exercise you're doing. You want to be a little anabolic. You want to make some muscles. And so you need some inflammation to do that, because in order to separate the cells to make new muscle cells, there's an inflammatory process that has to happen. So that's one of the good places that one of the good things that insulin does. But if you have too much insulin around and you're not particularly exercising, insulin is going to cause, it's still going to promote those inflammatory compounds. And so the more insulin you have around, the more inflamed you're going to be. And so people who don't exercise who have high insulin are going to be inflamed.
Sure.
They're going to have joint pain and they're going to have destruction of cells in their body. They're going to have destruction of cardiovascular, of their blood vessels. And when you get destruction of blood vessels in your body, you get irritation, inflammation, and then your body tries to patch them up. And guess what you get? Blockages in the arteries.
Ew.
Yeah.
That's not good.
So people with diabetes are more prone to cardiovascular disease.
Wow.
From having diabetes.
Right.
Yeah, because they have insulin regulation issues.
Well, they're prone to a lot of things.
So when you're type 1 diabetic, so mm-hmm. you're in a situation where your body doesn't make insulin because you don't have islets of Langerhans. So the islets of Langerhans are pooped out. So you could have autoimmune destruction. There's another condition where you can get diabetes secondary to the condition. You get type 1 diabetes secondary to the condition, destruction of the islets of Langerhans, and that's cystic fibrosis. And the reason that happens, so cystic fibrosis, the condition of cystic fibrosis is you have an extra gene that causes you to make too much mucus. So this mucus, you know, if you think of people with cystic fibrosis, they have lung problems. They get lung infections easily.
Right.
And they have to take N-acetylcysteine and mucus thinners, and you have to do tapotement on them. You have to bang on their lungs so they cough stuff up. That's what you think about. But you can make mucus, any extra mucus anywhere in your body. You can make it in your digestive system. You can also make it in the ducts of the pancreas. And if you make it enough in the ducts of the pancreas, it can block the pancreas and cause diabetes.
Wow.
So the insulin can't get out. Right. Yeah. So that's a thing that can happen. So anyway, if you have type 1 diabetes, you have to take insulin because your body doesn't make it. You can't live without insulin. So you have to take it, and you have to get your insulin level regulated. And the thing is, when you exercise, you increase your insulin sensitivity. Your body's like, okay, we got to get sugar into these cells. She's making me ride 113 miles. We need a lot of sugar in those cells. So let's do that. So your cells are going to get very sensitive to insulin, and any sugar that's going in is going to get burned up. So all your cells are like, all right, let's bond that insulin and get the sugar in, because we got to get over that hill. That's what's going to happen. And so your cells are going to be primed for that insulin. And because they're so sensitive and they want to bond the insulin, you don't need as much. So if you can take less insulin exogenously, that's a good thing. Because remember, insulin causes inflammation. And too much insulin will cause insulin resistance. And insulin causes fat storage. So if you can ingest less insulin, that's a good thing. So you want to need as little insulin as possible when you're type 1 diabetic. Or if you're insulin dependent, if you're type 2 diabetic, same thing. Because people get to a point where they have type 2 diabetes and their pancreas shuts down. Because they made so much insulin, the pancreas just can't do it anymore. That happens too. And they had type 2 diabetes, but now they need insulin because their pancreas just couldn't. It overproduced, and the islets of Langerhans got tuckered out. That happens too. So if you have type 2 diabetes, you're in a place where you're still making insulin. If you get exercise, that makes you more insulin sensitive as well. And your insulin values will drop and your blood sugar will tend to drop. And you can, type 2 diabetes, it is possible. I'm not going to say it's possible in every case, but it is possible to control type 2 diabetes just with diet and exercise. And exercise, as I said, makes you more sensitive to that insulin, so your body doesn't overproduce the insulin, and you increase your insulin sensitivity, so your insulin levels will tend to drop, and you will reduce your inflammation and your tendency to store extra body fat. So of course, cycling is going to help reduce your risk of diabetes. So let's see what the study said. It says here, so we'll go through the study. A two-wheel ride instead of four... of course, could help lower the risk of developing type 2 diabetes among adults. And this was a Danish study. We're going to see my Danish uncle this weekend.
Yes.
Yeah. It's very nice.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Yeah. So people who rode a bike to work or cycle, and my uncle doesn't drive a car.
Right.
And when he's in the Hamptons, you know how he gets around?
Bicycle.
Yep. That's right, because that's what you do in Denmark.
He's Danish.
He's Danish.
He's Danish. They have highways for bicycles.
Oh! You're going to have a blast talking to Uncle Ben. Oh, my goodness.
I will. Yeah. It'll be fun. I can't wait.
Yeah. So people who rode a bike to work or cycled just for fun were less likely to get the illness, researchers found. This was true even for those who only began habitual cycling later in life, like me, because I was later in life, 40. Yeah, I was old when I started cycling regularly. So anyway, the cohort study, which was led by Rotten Masmussen from the University of Southern Denmark, involved about 24,000 males and 27,000 females from Denmark who were recruited at the age of 50 to 65 years old. Woohoo! Because I'm 52. Researchers examined the link between the study participants' self-reported commuter and recreational cycling habits and their type 2 diabetes incidence, which was already measured in the Danish National Diabetes Registry. In the end, Rasmussen and his team found the participants who biked habitually had lesser chances of developing type 2 diabetes. The more time these participants spent cycling, the lower the risk for diabetes. So the more miles and the more hours, the less diabetes you have. After 5 years, the biking habits of participants were reevaluated. Those who began riding a bike on a regular basis faced a 20% reduced risk for type 2 diabetes than participants who didn't practice it. Rasmussen and his colleagues took into account other factors that could have influenced participants' diabetes risk, including diet, waist circumference, history of smoking, alcohol consumption, and other forms of exercise. They acknowledged that other factors could have affected the results of the study, which only discovered an association between risk for type 2 diabetes and bicycling habits, but not a cause and effect relationship. What they found most interesting is the fact that those who started the habit later in life had a lower risk of type 2 diabetes as well, given that the participants were men and women of middle and old age. The results underline that even when a person enters older age, it is not too late to go cycling to reduce the risk. So another reason to get on your bike, you are less likely to get diabetes. You heard it here. Rasmussen says cycling can be added to a person's everyday routine. Well, it sure can. You can bike to work. You can bike to the store. You don't have to do crazy stuff like I do. And I do crazy stuff. I think that what I did on Sunday was pretty nuts. I rode 113 miles in Vermont. It was beautiful. I climbed 41 over 8,000 feet, and it was so beautiful. Vermont is just such a beautiful state. I climbed three gaps. I climbed the Brandon Gap, the Baby Gap, and the App Gap, and it was just tremendous. The App Gap was very, very hard, and I climbed it, but I actually walked 200 meters of it, just 200 meters. But, you know, I did most of, I've almost to the top, walked 200 meters and rode the rest of the way to the top. And I don't mind admitting that. it was tough. And it was also at mile 68 of a 113-mile ride. And there were some beautiful rolling roads. Route 100 is just spectacular and beautiful and not very busy with traffic. It was just a spectacular ride. And Vermont is beautiful. The people are beautiful. The Warren General Store was amazing. I just had an absolutely wonderful time. And Tyler Wren of Renegade Sports put on a terrific event, the Farm to Fork Fondo. And we had a really nice time. And Ron worked there doing Bianchi stuff. And I rode the ride, and we just had a lovely time. Anyway, so I had a really good time reducing my diabetes, and then I rode nice and easy the next couple of days. So that was really good. So the details of this study were published in the journal PLOS Medicine. So if you want to look at PLOS Medicine, you can read the study. So like I said, it was done at the University of Southern Denmark, and the Martin Rasmussen was the chief scientist in this study. So very interesting. All right. So you heard it here. If you ride a bike, you're less likely to get diabetes.
Yeah, or if you're just active in general,
oh,
right?
Yeah, that's
I mean,
true.
Really, you know, we went out for a great walk this morning. Really this nice walk.
That's great.
You know, just shy of 4 miles this mm-hmm. morning. Very nice.
Oh, no.
Oh,
get
what?
This. The norovirus struck the Republican National Convention.
Is that what went wrong?
Is that the only thing? I don't know, but that's funny. I'm sorry. I feel bad if people got the norovirus is not fun.
No.
You know what the norovirus is?
Are you being like, is this a comical moment here? Is this, or are you being serious?
No, I see it in the news.
The norovirus
struck the Republican National Convention.
Okay, this isn't something from The Onion?
No, it's not. It's the Washington Post.
Okay, so what is the norovirus?
It's acute it's a virus that causes acute gastroenteritis. It causes, you know, vomiting, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea.
That's not good.
So it's running through the...
That'd be very unpleasant.
So if you're at the RNC, just a word to the wise, if you can hold anything down, it's time to go get some grapeseed extract.
Oh, my God.
And kefir.
Oh, my God.
Remember when Nancy came over with and you and I didn't, we were a little off, but we drank kefir and we took grapeseed extract and we were fine.
Right.
So if you take grapeseed extract regularly, you're less like, if they would take grapeseed extract, they might not have gotten it. Or if they drank kefir or did other probiotics.
I know that there's some people that are not feeling well, but this does have some.
There's a
big doors you can open here.
I'm sure somebody's busy opening those doors.
I'm sure the folks that run the Daily Show and
we're going to have to figure out my DVR.
Are probably having a good time with
this. We have that DVR machine and we haven't set it up. We have to set it up tonight because we have to. Okay. There's some stuff we have to
remind me and let's find some time to do that.
Yeah.
And we'll do it.
I know.
If we have the time.
I know.
All right. We have other things going on this evening.
Yes, we do.
So, anyway. Yeah. And we're down to.
I was gonna talk about food intolerances, but I guess I'll talk about
goodness.
That another time.
You know what? I'm gonna make a note then on that so that we talk about it the next time.
We'll talk about it another time, but that's too bad. So if you should get acute gastroenteritis, like I said, my two favorites. I used to recommend other things, but you know, there's the Brat diet, your bananas. Right, and certainly taking if you have acute gastroenteritis, you know, vomiting and diarrhea. You can take a couple of pills of activated charcoal. I don't like people to take activated charcoal all the time because it'll suck out all your nutrients. It sucks out whatever's in there. But if you have acute gastroenteritis, it's not a bad thing to take because you want to suck out whatever's in there.
Yeah,
so activated charcoal is another thing you can take.
Something's causing a problem down there.
It's going to cause you to have black stools. Don't worry about it. It's just the charcoal coming out. And then your probiotic of whatever form. If you are not dairy intolerant, kefir is great. If you are, water kefir is great. And probiotic pills are fine. And then grapeseed extract. All right. So you have been listening to 91.7 FM WHUS Storrs. I am Fran Storch. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath. And it's been a great time here this week. And we will be back next week with more Radio Naturopath here on WHUS 91.7 FM.